This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. With your host, Joe Maga.
Hello, soccer fans. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago, editor of the FC Yahoo blog. Here with me in the Playa Vista podcasting room and producing for Shahan Ahmed, who's on the road on assignment, as they say in the news business, is Joey Galino.
And let me tell you something. I am drunk with power.
Sitting to my right, Joey's to my left, sitting to my right is Alex Baker.
The madman on the mic.
And, of course, on Skype from New York, Leander Charlakis.
The most important tournament is now the UEFA Europa League.
Your tone doesn't reflect your column on Ajax. There's some positivity to that.
It doesn't. The cynic in me kind of takes over when I start to write, but the fan in me is really glad to see Ajax do something.
That makes me happy.
Let me just substitute cynic with the Dutch person in you.
So, breaking news here. Zlatan Ibrahimovic is out with knee ligament damage. He's out until January. An injury that he suffered in Man United's quarterfinal victory over Anderlecht. The big question is, what does this mean for Man United? Joey, what do you think?
It's a big blow. Marcus Rashford has obviously emerged as a more reliable goal scorer for them, and it seems like he definitely has a big future with the club, but there's no denying that Zlatan is their talisman, so to speak. He's dangerous. He's still, even at, you know, I think he's in his mid-30s now, he gets into dangerous areas on a routine basis. He scores big goals and big moments, and, you know, let's be honest, the Manchester United is not playing for the Premier League title. They're obviously not in the Champions League. If they want to get back into the Champions League, as we've discussed, the most important the most effective way for them to do that might be to win the Europa League. And that's going to be, again, a big moment. And if you don't have someone like Zlatan who's experienced in these kind of big matches, regardless of whatever competition it is, I think it's going to hurt. And it's not just that he's out for this season. It's out for, you know, he's out until next January. So I don't know how it can be anything other than not a crippling blow, but a pretty big blow.
What's amazing about Zlatan is that at his advanced age of 35, he didn't just lead Manchester United in scoring this season. He led it in scoring this season plus last season when he wasn't even at the club. I mean, so far this year, he had 28 goals, and nobody in the last year and a half has scored that many goals for Man United. Now, when they signed him over the summer, as you'll recall, there were a lot of doubts about the guy. They said, okay, so he scored 38 goals last year in the league alone and 50 overall, which was actually his most productive year of his career by far. His four seasons at Paris Saint-Germain were all sort of, was certainly his most productive four-year run. But they said, yeah, but it's the French league, and, you know, the defending isn't always that good, and Paris Saint-Germain was so dominant and running away with it. There were real doubts about him. Now it's gotten to the point where, you know, a few months into the season, I think Jose Mourinho was saying, you know, he would do anything to keep the guy for the year when he turns 36. So there's no doubt that even at this age, Zlatan is absolutely crucial to Manchester United. And that's even more true when you look at the rest of the roster. So, you know, with him out, what does that leave you with? You've got Wayne Rooney, who has declined very quickly, and I think pretty steadily since about 2010 or thereabouts. 2011, I think, was one of his last really good years. Then you've got Anthony Martial, who's young and who I think is going to be very good someday, but he's inconsistent. And Marcus Rashford is a teenager. And the old trope about young players is that from game to game, you just don't know what you're going to get. They're going to have a few good games, and then they're going to have a bad one, and they're unreliable. And for a team that so badly needs the goals, it's pretty scary, I think, to have to face at least the rest of this season and the first half of the next if they don't sign somebody else dependent on Martial and Rashford for goals.
So Rashford came through with the extra time winner to send United through to the Europa League semis. Alex, but who do you see picking up the slack? Well, who can handle the burden? And is it necessarily a forward that has to, one of the three that Leander mentioned, or is it this is the time where someone like Paul Pogba needs to, you know, take more of a responsibility?
Sure, Pogba. I mean, you know, you look at Ibra's numbers, he's got 28 goals, but he also has 9 assists. He's joint top assist maker for United. He's created 88 chances. So, you know, we know that Pogba's not really defined by scoring goals, but he said about himself that he's an assist maker. So, you know, if he can start creating those chances and filling in, setting up guys like Rashford and Martial, but that's a pretty big if. And I think we can all agree Ibrahimovic has really carried this team for long stretches of the season. And, you know, Jose Mourinho does not have a great record of bringing young players through to fruition. So you look at a guy like Rashford, you think he's going to foster under Mourinho. I think it's a big ask, but this is definitely opening up an opportunity, as Joe says, for Pogba maybe to step up and become the player he was bought to be.
Do you think Mourinho now will choose? He said in his post-game press conference that he's still competing on the two fronts, but even more so with Zlatan out, do you think he really has to choose the one? Well, we've all said Europa League is their best path to qualifying for the Champions League. Do you think Mourinho has to make that call now and just, you know, the Premier League is something that he needs to deprioritize?
Under normal circumstances, you might say that they still have a chance in the Premier League because they've got two games in hand on Liverpool, who is 6 points ahead of them. Now, you never can assume anything, I guess, but you could be level on points with Liverpool if you win those two games in hand. City's got one game in hand, and they're only 4 points ahead of United. So you look at it and you kind of say, well, they still do have a fighting chance in the league to get to the top four. But then you take a look at what they have left in the Europa League, and you say, well, that figures to be, at least on paper, an easier way to go about it. I think inside the club, it might not be imprudent to say, again, if it comes to making the Champions League and choosing between the two paths, no disrespect to Celta Vigo, I would choose that path over the one where you have to pursue Pep Guardiola's Man City and Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool.
I'm not so sure, though. I mean, I know it's Celta Vigo. They're not Atletico Madrid or Barcelona, but you know, Man United's record against Spanish teams, and basically Premier League teams' record against Spanish teams, is not so hot lately. The Spanish league, it has a lot of quality, and an Ibra-less Man United, I think that they're pretty vulnerable to Celta Vigo.
I love that Alex pronounces it Celta.
Good for you.
Listen, Ace Milan.
Well, so let's get into the Celta Vigo matchup. I mean, if this Europa League is the best path for advancing or qualifying for Champions League, and if Ibra is not going to be around to do what he does, I mean, do you see Man United being able to get past?
Well, here's what I'm thinking about United overall, and I've kind of focused on this. We could go all day and break down the matchups and things like that, and you're certainly right, Alex. United's record against Spanish opposition and even the EPL as a whole is not very stellar, but that doesn't change the fact that this United side, they haven't lost in a long, long time. I don't think they've lost in the league since the Chelsea away game. So it just seems like they're able to get results, even if they're not reeling off the wins. You know, what have we been saying about Chelsea this year and why they're kind of ahead of the pack in the Premier League? It can be boiled down to as simple as Chelsea's winning matches and other sides are dropping points because they have way more draws than Chelsea. And I look at it from the standpoint, United, again, hasn't lost in the league in forever. They haven't had a loss that I can recall fairly recently. So that tells me that if you kind of flip what I just said about Chelsea, at least they're getting results. At least they're getting points. Now, I'm not saying that it's impossible for Celta Vigo to go in there and get a result against Man United and look really good doing it, but I do kind of trust that fight within Man United, even if Zlatan is not a part of it right now.
But we've seen recently, well, we saw proof just last week. Mourinho controversially sat Zlatan, and they were against Chelsea at Old Trafford, and they were still able to beat them 2-0. Zlatan came on late as a sub, but they already had the game in hand. So we know, you know, that they're capable of getting results without Zlatan, but you know, even bigger than that is I feel like Mourinho has figured out, you know, the pieces of this team, and whether it's the team is has adjusted and is comfortable to what he wants them to do. This is something that we saw when he had his second time around at Chelsea, where guys like Eden Hazard, players who weren't around for his first stint at Chelsea, adjusted to you know, the way he plays. Now, it went sideways quickly after they won the league. But I think what you're seeing right now under Mourinho, it seems like, and this is a happy Mourinho. You know, Mourinho in his post-game press is obviously winning. he's not always happy after wins. But it seems like I could sense the confidence of a Jose Mourinho with this Man United side right now. So, you know, as daunting as it is to try to get past the Spanish side in the semifinal of a European competition, you know, don't count out Jose Mourinho.
I think it's going to be sort of a cumulative effort of replacing Zlatan, because there's a few guys coming out of the midfield who are good for a few goals. You know, Juan Mata has 10 goals on the season in all competitions. Henrik Mkhitaryan, after a slow start, has 10 goals, which is actually both tied for Rashford for the second most on the team. Obviously, Zlatan's 28. That hurts, but Paul Pogba actually has 7 across all competitions. Jesse Lingard has 5. And so I think when you take those guys together, maybe you can sort of fashion a Zlatan starter kit out of those different pieces. You know, you can use Marouane Fellaini when you need more of a target guy, which is a scary thought to a lot of people I know. I think they're going to be okay. It's obviously painful, but I think they still have enough to win the Europa League. I never did fancy them to get back into the top four for the Premier League. But you know, if that's where they focus and they rotate their players a little bit so everybody's fresh for the Celta game and the final, it's just 3 games, which is actually an easier task than winning the Premier League, where there's more games left. So you know, I do think they have enough, but it's gonna take a team effort.
Yeah, and I just real quick, I think that this is fairly easy to break down how you're going to handle this Zlatan situation. Now, there's reports that they're already looking into whether or not they have to pay him the rest of his contract if he's not going to be coming back until the middle of next season. But you can look at it like, well, United is approaching it. That's the long term, basically, is what I'm trying to say. The short term, as Leander was saying, you've basically got the rest of the league season, which is only a few matches, and then you've got what you're really probably going to prioritize, the Europa League, which is, what, 3 matches max? So you have a very defined short term where you have to figure out how to replace Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And even if you would like more games to be able to figure it out, the fact remains that that can be a blessing and a curse. You don't really have to deal with that problem for very long this season in order to get what you want.
Here's a question for you guys. Does Zlatan Ibrahimovic play for Manchester United again?
I was going to bring that up. I was going to ask you guys, you know, did we just see the last game that Zlatan plays for Man United? Because with all the chatter about, you know, him coming to MLS, he's been a target for the LA Galaxy for quite a while now. He's already, for himself, he's already claimed that he's proved that he can play or dominate, as he, you know, says, dominate in the Premier League. So, essentially, in his mind, maybe there's nothing left for him to prove other than to lead Man United to silverware, which I think was a secondary goal of his. He was there just because Mourinho had asked him to come and help, and he did, and he was the guy. So, you know, I'll throw it to you guys. Do you think he's going to be back? Is this it for Zlatan at United?
There's an awful lot of talk from people saying, well, that's the last we'll hear of Zlatan. I don't think that's true, because if at 35 you can be as productive and as dominant as he has been, I don't see why 8 months out would sort of make you any less good at 36. I mean, he's clearly aged very well as a player. Maybe he loses a step, but he was never that quick to begin with. You know, maybe he jumps a little less high, but he wasn't, you know, he never really jumped out of the gym. He was just a tall guy. He wasn't all that reliant on his physical tools and never has been. So I'm not so worried about that. I don't see a drop off like with a guy like Radamel Falcao, who took like 3 years to get back to where he was after a serious knee injury. If I'm Manchester United, I'm calling his agent right now and asking to sit down to talk about his contract, because A, maybe you get a discount if you do it now, because you're basically buying, you know, 8 months of inactivity, but you get him for the second half of next season when you'll probably need him in some fashion. And B, it sort of gives Zlatan a little bit of security. This is probably a tough time for him, and he would appreciate the gesture. I think if anything, this isn't the time for United to try to vacate his existing contract. I think it's time to try to sign him up to the next one.
Yeah, I think if you look at the timeline again, what better January signing, so to speak, could you have than a healthy Zlatan Ibrahimovic returning to the team? So you got to look at it that way. And I also think, correct me if I'm wrong, Zlatan has always been a guy who moves almost mercenarily from team to team to try to prove himself in different places for different managers, different competitions, all that. I don't know. Has he ever proven himself like coming back from a major injury? I don't know if he's ever had one like this. So that might be like a new challenge for him, is what I'm saying. And, again, I agree with you, Andrew. Just that fact alone, neither him nor United should give up on this.
Yeah, I can't recall him ever having this kind of injury that sidelined him for 6 months or more. And with a lot of guys, Joe and I in the last couple of years in our befuddling amateur sports careers have gone through serious knee injuries, and it's a lot to come back. And with a lot of players at that age, you might think this could be the end, and you wouldn't slight them for it. I remember when Beckham got hurt badly at 35, he actually said one time at a press conference that I was at that he considered that maybe it was time to hang him up. But this is Zlatan Ibrahimovic we're talking about. This guy's a competitor. He's pretty fierce, and it's either going to be the perfect time to join MLS, or he's going to come back and be that kind of second half of the season guy for United that they'll need.
I don't know why when Leander was talking about an aging, immobile, not moving as well as he used to, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, the image of Emil Heskey came into my head for some reason. But I think, obviously, it would be Emil Heskey with actually some skills of setting up other people, But that's what came to my head. So, let's move on to the Champions League semifinal draw. We have another Madrid derby. Whether you're excited about that or not, doesn't matter.
You're getting it anyway.
We're going to have at least 180 minutes of the Madrid teams again in the top club competition. But the other semifinal will be intriguing because you have Monaco and all of its young attacking talent against Juventus, which really did the job on Barcelona. And that's where I think we should begin, is with Barcelona and Bayern before we get into these semifinal ties. I was calling it an autopsy before we got on the podcast, but what happened to, we'll start with Barcelona. What happened to them? Why was Juve able to impose its defensive will so easily, especially in the return leg where, there are some factors, there was a right type of officiating where they're letting things go as the frustration built for Barcelona in that first half. I could see that there was no comeback happening again. There's no miracle for Barcelona this time. But I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on what was the one thing that stood out for you guys in this quarterfinal loss by Barca.
It was that when we talked about the matches, the quarterfinal ties beforehand, I brought up the fact that this Barcelona side looked a little ripe for picking. And I was worried about the recent evidence of the 4-0 against Paris Saint-Germain. And while I didn't necessarily think that would happen again, although Juventus was quite convincing in that first leg, I did think it exposed certain things like the lack of squad depth. The Pedros and Alexis Sanchez's are not there anymore. It's a thinner squad than before, regardless of how talented it is. It seems to be a squad that doesn't play well for whatever reason away from home. They've struggled in big matches and the Champions League and La Liga away from home this year, and obviously they were away from home to start both the PSG round of 16 tie and the Juventus quarterfinal tie, and it caught up to them. And I think reports of their demise are a little over-exaggerated. I mean, Messi's still he's got 45 goals in 44 games this year. If that's his down year, he is definitely the greatest player of all time as far as I'm concerned. However, the squad isn't as complete. There have been tactical errors. Jeremy Mathieu in the first leg, we talked about that. Rakitic maybe not played when or where he should be at certain times. And when it comes to that point, when you get to that point, you can't just rely on the brilliance of Suarez and Messi and Neymar to bail you out on a consistent basis, because as brilliant as they are, you're facing the very best defenses like Juve, and if they wouldn't have had to face Juve, maybe they would have to face Atleti or Real Madrid, who's won this competition the last couple of years. So when you get to this point and the margins are so incredibly fine in terms of how brilliant these sides are, all those things added up can really matter. So, I'm not calling this the demise of Barcelona as we know it, but it's pretty clear that there have to be some changes.
I think it is actually the demise. I think that this team is really atrophied from the team that won the competition a couple of years ago. You only need to look as far as Juventus, who was their opposition in that final, to see that Juventus has kept progressing and building and getting stronger and getting better. Barcelona has not moved forward and has backslid. And even if you go back to that winning season 2 years ago, there's an argument that really Messi carried them through a lot of games. And he seems to have sort of lost that knack for getting them out of jail free that he had back then. But I really think when you start to look at the bigger picture, this team has been in decline for quite a few years, maybe, since Guardiola left. And I know there's been a few high points that have sort of been in there, but maybe those mask the bigger truth that I think this team has been in decline for about 4 or 5 years.
Is that something that whoever they bring in to replace Luis Enrique, is it, whatever declining Messi that we have right now, is that really a more significant factor than, whatever change a new coach can bring?
I don't know that this is a problem of a declining Messi. I don't know that he is declining. I think he had a bad series. I mean, he was visibly off the pace against Juve in the second game. Just shots that he would have converted. You would bet your house on half the shots he took going in, and all of them didn't. I think in all, Barca took something like at least a dozen shots, and only one of them was on target, and that just doesn't happen all that much. And between that and Juve's defensive effort, I mean, it was kind of a perfect storm for defeating Barcelona. But I think there's a lot of truth to what you guys are saying, because, first of all, soccer games tend to be won by whichever team has the least guys not playing up to their standard. And it used to be with Barcelona that even if a few guys were off the pace, they had so many weapons that could compensate. I mean, even before they had Suarez and Neymar joining Messi, they had guys like David Villa, Iniesta, who I think has fallen off in the last year or two, used to be more reliably brilliant. They had Xavi, they had Dani Alves coming out of the defense. They had Pique, who I think was more of an attacking factor back then. They had Alexis, they had Pedro, they had Cesc Fabregas, they had Thiago. They just used to have more weapons, which made it okay when a guy like Messi wasn't up to his best self. I don't think this Barcelona team is done for. I don't think the dynasty is over, which you can trace back about a decade now. But I think that they need to go out on the market and just get some more attacking weapons. I think they did a good job last summer of getting some defensive depth, notably with Samuel Umtiti, which was something they very badly needed. They got it. They got some useful defenders. They could use another one or two. I think they're mostly okay in midfield, even though Andre Gomes has been disappointing. But I think they just need an attacker or two, just another guy who can come off the bench and threaten.
Yeah, I think ever since Pep left, they've kind of been caught in this weird realm where they want to try to approximate what they did. But going back to the players that were there before, Xavi very much controlled the pace of every game. He's arguably the greatest midfielder of all time, and just so patient and precise and can see things develop before they do. And the rest of the team kind of played off that. For as brilliant as those other players are, he was sort of like the fulcrum of it. And when Pep was there, obviously the players, Leander, you mentioned that Pique was a little more attack minded. I think the defenders all were, in the sense that Pep didn't want defenders who could only defend. He wanted guys who could play passes forward and kind of build things out of the back. This all goes back to that tiki-taka style, and now it's more like, instead of asking the defense to be part of it like that and kind of wheeling those wingbacks forward and getting into the attack and things like that, Barcelona's more asking the defense to just kind of, okay, plug the dam, because we're not sure what's going to happen with the possession we've got up here. We just know we've got four great attacking players and a couple other guys who can fill in up there. So they're kind of, it seems a little more disjointed. It's not the complete team that it's been. And a lot of the talent that they have sort of papers over those cracks. Like, they're playing Mascherano at center back these days, and you could argue that's playing him out of position. And it's just, overall, it's not the same cohesive unit that it was in the past. And again, the talent is kind of covered up for that, but you just can't do that forever. And this is what we're seeing now. We're seeing that fall off and kind of bring them to where they are at this point.
We've seen Ronaldo show signs of what he's going to be as he gets older. He is going to be a number nine. as he loses another step. But what do you guys see? What does a older Lionel Messi look like? Like, well, what is his position? I think he's obviously more somewhere in the middle of the park. I just don't see him being able to handle being a forward. Maybe whenever that happens, I think when he starts losing a step, his best position will be somewhere in central midfield. What do you guys think?
I think that's a really good question, because in a lot of ways, I think Messi is less equipped to be aging than Ronaldo is, because Ronaldo has this big frame and he's athletic and he's fast and he jumps high. And it's not like Messi isn't fast, and he actually has a pretty good spring for a guy his size. But Ronaldo has sort of this muscular quality to him where he could push past guys that Messi didn't have as much. I mean, he was stocky and he had a low center of gravity. But when Messi loses a step, he's in trouble. I think you might be right that he winds up being more of a number 10. But, you know, it's not like he can be – Ronaldo could play as a target man if he wanted to. He could do what Zlatan has done for the last 10 years and just kind of hang out all the way at the top of the formation and wait for service, which is kind of what he's been doing the last few years. But he could really become this stationary player because he's so tall and he's so good with his head. But Messi can't really do that. So, you know, the decline of Messi, I think, will start to set in as soon as he starts to slow down.
Yeah, I think if Messi is to reinvent himself, it's going to be more in the Xavi pass master, as Leander says, more of a number 10. Somebody who's, you know, behind the immediate front line, but is just spraying amazing passes and maybe popping up with a deep-line goal or in the right place to knock balls. But I don't think he'll be an out-and-out goal scorer in his mid-30s.
Yeah, I've thought about this for a while, actually, and it's always occurred to me that if he wants to know what he's going to become as he gets a little bit older, and I think we all agree he still has plenty of years of effectiveness, and just in terms of, like, he can still play for a number of years, I think he just has to kind of turn around and look at Andres Iniesta and Xavi and say, well, you don't have the frame of a Ronaldo, but one thing everyone knows about the goals Messi scored, he set a number of records in that regard, but he's also an incredibly visionary passer. Like, he sees, he's kind of got that Xavi gene where he can see certain things happening before they do. And if he can kind of amend that to, from leading the line to, yeah, playing in maybe that number 10 role or more of a playmaker, then he could still be a very effective weapon for years to come, whether it's at Barcelona or maybe he goes somewhere else.
Yeah, it'll be a deep lying 10 with someone else doing the running.
Make a great MLS forward.
Man, oh man.
So as we've, you know.
Are you paid by MLS?
You know, this is the first time in 10 years that Barca and Bayern won't be in the Champions League semifinal. So let's unpack, you know, what happened to Bayern. I think we will all agree there were some questionable calls that went against them that played a big role in their demise. But, you know, you could blame the referees, obviously, and that would be it. But was there something else to what happened to Bayern against Real Madrid? You know, Lewandowski's injury was obviously a factor in the first leg, but is there something else that went awry for Carlo Ancelotti's team?
I'll go out and say this and sort of put myself out there to be fired back at, if you will. I don't think so. I am not worried about this Bayern Munich side in the slightest. I think that they have a lot of talent. That, you know, you look at the team and say, who's aging? The Arjen Robins, the Frank Ribberys, they're probably not as effective as they've been. One could argue Ancelotti made a mistake by kind of being beholden to those guys instead of starting Douglas Costa in both legs and adding a little more dynamism on the wings. But to me, that's something that is not – I never like to use the term easily fixable, because I don't think any fix that matters is easy. But you could very much see them going out in the transfer market and getting a winger who'd want to play for Bayern Munich, or giving more minutes to Kingsley Coman. You know, again, an increased role for Douglas Costa. You could see maybe buying center half reinforcement, because Javi Martinez did not give a grand account of himself over this two-leg tie. And you go back to what you said about the bad breaks. I certainly don't want to take anything away from Real Madrid, because at this point of the season, you have to do what you have to do to advance. But in the first leg, it was clear that the formation without Robert Lewandowski up top struggled with Thomas Muller up there. And, they, you know, again, they pushed up Arturo Vidal, and it wasn't the same. And Real Madrid capitalized on that. And again, without Mats Hummels, Martinez's regular center half pairing in there, he made some mistakes and got that stupid red card. And that kind of helped Real Madrid get that second goal, which proved to be vital. And in this past match, Bayern was playing a very effective game for a long period of time, and then they had the really, really bad call against Vidal, who got pretty much all ball, and yet it gave him a second yellow, and he was sent off. And, you know, it just seems like the breaks did not go Bayern's way, by and large. I can't really even think of one that they did get over the course of this two-leg tie. And so when you talk about having all that said, and you still kind of push – not to the limit, but push pretty hard the defending Champions League winner who's won it two of the past 3 years and has one of the greatest players of all time, Ronaldo. I struggle to see how this is an issue.
I can see that argument, but I don't know. You know, like if Manuel Neuer hadn't stood on his head in that first leg, they'd have got pasted.
That's fair.
We'd be looking at an embarrassing scoreline. You got two guys in two legs, each getting red carded. So, you know, what's going on with that? I don't think Vidal's red card, when he got it, was justified, but I think cumulatively he had earned that red card in that game. So maybe you've got some disciplinary issues. I mean, I don't think you've got to, you know, fire Ancelotti or anything, but this is actually, I think, the oldest per capita, like, man-for-man team in the Bundesliga right now. So they need kind of a makeover, maybe not a major revision, but they need a freshening up Bayern, I think.
I think we have to keep in mind as well that Ronaldo sort of, which he's prone to do, occasionally he'll have this spasm of old Ronaldoism, kind of like he had in when Portugal and Sweden played that playoff to get into the Euro, I think it was, or maybe it was the World Cup, I can't remember, but when he scored like 5 goals in the home and away series and he basically dragged Portugal into the tournament all by himself, he's still prone to doing that every now and again. He scored both goals in the first leg, even though he wasn't dominant, and then he scored the first 3 in the second one, and I think we can't really discount that. I mean, to me, he's the second greatest player of all time, and he just kind of took his team on his shoulders in this series. And when a guy like that can still play that way, there's not really a whole lot you can do.
So after Johan Cruyff, it's Ronaldo on your list?
don't bait me, Joe.
Well, let's talk about Real Madrid. Perfect segue. I am not excited for another Madrid derby even at this stage of the Champions League. I was hoping we would split these teams up at least, but you know, full credit to the Madrid teams getting there. Atletico Madrid really didn't have all that, you know, against Bayer Leverkusen they weren't really pressed, and Leicester did all they could. You know, actually Leicester really applied pressure late in that game. It was really one-way traffic in the return leg. And Jan Oblak actually had to come up with some really good saves. But are you guys excited about seeing another Atletico Madrid, Real Madrid knockout stage tie? It's not a final, it's a semifinal. Or are you interested in watching this?
I'm excited that it's not the final. That's the best thing about this, is that it precludes
that is not a
having
confidence
another
for
them. That's Real Madrid final. But I'm excited about it. It's sort of like that one season in La Liga about 4 or 5 years ago when Mourinho was there, and there are about 6 Clásicos in 3 months. This is sort of a derby that, especially in the latter stages of the Champions League, we've seen a lot of it in the last few years, and the sheen has worn off it a little bit.
One thing I will say is that if there's a rooting interest or a reason why I would root for one of these teams is, I would like to see Diego Simeone actually beat Real Madrid for once and get to the final. You know, we have a guy who works here who's actually from Madrid, and he actually told me while I was getting lunch today, he's a Real Madrid supporter. He said he wouldn't mind seeing Diego Simeone for all what he's done for Atletico Madrid's club to reap the reward of a European Cup, of a Champions League title. And you know, I think that shows how much respect this guy has in Spain and in Madrid, that, you know, no matter what you think, if you're an Atleti supporter or a Real Madrid supporter, you have to give it up for Diego Simeone for what he's been able to get out of this team. We say the same thing every year, like, how are they here? But it's because of him and his will to get these guys to produce on the field.
Yeah, I would actually argue that this draw provides the most interesting possibilities – of any of them. And what I mean by that is this. I, too, have a little bit of fatigue with the Madrid Derby being this late again, and I'm glad it's kind of not the final, because how many more talking points can we have leading up over a course of 3 weeks to that match? However, now you set it up where one of these teams is going to be playing in the final, and they're either going to be playing Juve, who is very interesting and trying to get, you know, Italy back on top of the mountain in Europe in its own right, or Monaco, which, imagine all that attacking talent they have just flying forward against one of the Madrid sides in a final. And you could argue that the two Madrid sides would both be favored over Monaco in a final, regardless of who wins. And you're not entirely sure, even with Real being the defending champion, that you'd say the same thing necessarily about them against Juventus. So I think there's a lot of interesting things that are happening here. And it's almost, I think to myself, because I agree with you guys, like the Madrid Derby fatigue at this point of the competition is kind of setting in. But then I think to myself, if that's the worst part of the semifinals, is that we're going to get a fantastic matchup between these two clubs again. I feel kind of bratish saying
another
that.
Another Madrid derby.
It's Ronaldo and all those great players on Real Madrid playing against Simeone and his well-drilled Atletico side with Antoine Griezmann in supreme form. Oh, it's so bad.
Attacking talent against defensive wherewithal.
I'll sum it up with this, I think. If I were more into tactics, I'd be excited.
So when we do have a very intriguing semifinal in the other semifinal with Monaco and Juventus, and you would think that this is really Juve's, you know, semifinal tie to lose, but you know, after what we've seen, what Monaco has done in this tournament and what they're doing in Liga, I know none of us watch Ligue 1 religiously, but you know, they're still in the league, but they're level on points with PSG. If our Ligue 1 standings are correct on the Yahoo Sports site. But you know, Monaco is still pumping in goals. If you go among the remaining of the final four, they've scored 21. That's second among the four. Real Madrid has scored 28 in the competition. So you can't ignore what this team is capable of. When I watch Kylian Mbappe, I wish they would, on the screen, kind of like when you play FIFA, if you can turn on, you know, you can see the, if you want to, the notification of who you're actually controlling. Every time he scores, they should have like a number of what his transfer fee is up to. Because that's all I think of when one of these young guys has done something, whether it's Mendy or him, you know, or Bernardo Silva, that's all I think about. Because I feel like we're not going to see this team together next year.
Yeah, I think it presents well, because if you just look at it strictly from what you might expect to happen, well, Juve just doesn't give up goals. They just don't. And Monaco just doesn't not score goals. They just don't. Even if their players are young, they're going to want to come out and say, okay, this is the best defensive side in Europe. We want to be able to prove ourselves here. Because I personally look at it where they beat Manchester City in the round of 16, which has kind of stumbled a little bit this season under Pep. And, you know, they barely did that. Then in the quarterfinals, not to put too fine a point on it and get too in it too much, but they did go to play the game at Dortmund when Dortmund had just been literally attacked the day before. So who knows where their mind frame was there. And obviously they did look very good in the second leg of that tie. But now they're kind of facing the informed team in this competition, if it's not Real Madrid. And so they might think to themselves, maybe they're thinking the same things I am. You know how young people are. They always look for slights to try to prove yourself and you know, inventing, if you have to, them judging you just to motivate yourself. They might think those very same things and say, okay, you know what you think of us, some people probably don't think we deserve to be here. We'll show you we deserve to be here by taking out arguably the best team in Europe. So I think it's, from that standpoint, it's a fantastically interesting matchup.
I really like Joey referring to quote-unquote young people, which I'm not sure how old he is. But
look at this hairline. Come on.
This is actually a rematch of a quarterfinal in the 2014-2015 season when Juventus would go on to the final and actually set a record for having lost the most Champions League finals with six. And in that series, there was one goal in 180 minutes, and that was from Vidal from a penalty, which was kind of... Back then, Juventus, I think, was as strong defensively as it is now. But Monaco was a very, very strong defensive team also. As you may recall, that year, they gave up almost no goals. And they've really evolved since then, though, in that they've become sort of this young, swaggering, attacking side. And they're now sort of more the opposite, where they're still a good defensive team, but they rely on their attack more. So I think this is going to be a pretty balanced matchup. I'm excited for this one.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty cool tie. I like that Joey has basically said that Monaco has a punk rock attitude that's going to give them an edge.
Yes.
And I can see the argument for that. And, you know, as everyone has said, you've got one of the best all-out attacking sides in Europe this season versus basically the best defensive one. You know, Juve, you would have to say, is the favorite, but I think it could go either way.
When Gianluigi Buffon said what he said about not wanting to face Leicester City, I think if you asked him who you didn't want to face second least, he'd probably answer this Monaco side. So if that really is in any way an indication into his thinking or the side's thinking, which I don't think is a huge stretch because, you know, he's a legend there and he kind of sets the tone for that dressing room. If that's really the attitude, then you'd be damn sure that Juventus is going to mind its P's and Q's and really take this match seriously, but also realize, you know, the kind of challenge that Monaco would present.
Yeah, I think it sets up nicely for Monaco, them playing at home first, if I have this correct, because then they can just go out and play the way they play, which is just, you know, not all out attack, but go for goals. And really, Juve just needs to, you know, leave Monaco not being down in such a massive hole.
The one thing I do wonder is with them being level on points with PSG in the league, it's almost, you know, again, going back to Mourinho and kind of like what you have to decide to focus on. Maybe it's not the same thing because it's a younger side and the legs are a little bit fresher than United. But, you know, does it creep into your mind we'd rather pursue league on because we do have a game in hand on PSG? And that seems, I would think, you know, obviously that's a more realistic thing to win right now and kind of snap that PSG run of supremacy than it is to win the Champions League. So how that factors into their approach and thinking, I think, is also something that could play a factor.
Well, you know, being young, you're greedy too.
Yes.
So really, yeah, it's, if there's something to be won, something to be achieved, you're just going to go for it.
Bigger picture, you know, Atletico Madrid was a team that not that long ago we weren't really used to seeing in this stage of the competition. Monaco on the verge of winning Ligue 1. A young team, as Joey said, is this a team that is it a fluke that they're here, or do you think this is a team that's going to be around at this stage of the competition for a while?
Well, I think what Leander brought up, and you know, it's a good point that they had played each other very recently in this competition, but one of the reasons it's interesting to look at, but not overly applicable to this matchup, is because it was such a different side back then. And I would be inclined to say that it depends, because I've pointed out before, Monaco, you go through the list of talent that's been mined from them over the years, and it's incredible. Yannick Carrasco, Anthony Martial, you know, they've lost a lot of really good young attackers. James Rodriguez. And they've replaced them. Now, obviously, you can't do that forever, but you figure that a club that's that well run, that, again, maybe if they win Ligue 1 this year, they're able to dip a little deeper into the transfer market and improve the squad. I am tempted to say that this is probably the beginning more than the end for Monaco, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I was going to wrap it up, but we're going to go long because I want to get your guys' thoughts on this World Cup joint bid between or among the U.S., Mexico and Canada. We haven't really discussed it. I was at the World Congress of Sports, which is put on by our friends at the Sports Business Daily, Sports Business Journal, down at Dana Point, a very swanky beach resort, places where I would never set foot in. You know, the first topic on the soccer panel with Sunil Gulati, Don Garber, and Victor Montagliani, who's the CONCACAF president in charge of Canada soccer too. It was the World Cup bid. And, you know, other than the first question about how the Trump administration is going to affect the bid, they were, you know, very happy, obviously, about getting together and in this joint bid. You know, the U.S. is going to get, if all the reports are correct, they're going to get 60 games and win 10 for Mexico, 10 for Canada. But my question to you guys is, you know, are you okay with that? Like, I felt like the U.S. could do this on their own, and I was really adamant about the U.S. hosting on their own. But if this is the best way for the U.S. to get a World Cup here for the first time since 1994, and we're still going to get all the good games, then I'm cool with it.
there's a long-running Twitter joke about referring to game theory and then sort of setting off on this long tangent about all your views in the world. But it actually sort of applies here, because by bringing in the neighboring countries, I think the U.S. is just curbing risk. And even if the ultimate outcome isn't quite as great as it would have been if they'd gone their own, it's the safe thing to do. I'm perfectly fine with it, A, because I think it's good for CONCACAF, but B, because if that locks up the bid at an early stage and the U.S. is apparently actually pushing to have the decision date moved up, it was ordinarily going to be, I think, May 2020, if I'm not mistaken, or May 20, yeah, I think 2020. They want to try to get it moved ahead. That's sort of how strong their bid is. If giving away 10 games out of 80 to either neighbor, and apparently the final is going to be in the U.S. and every knockout game from the quarterfinals onward is going to be in the U.S. So, you know, really what you're losing is early elimination games and some knockout stage games, you know, probably the ones involving Canada and Mexico, etc., which is fine. That's not such a big price to pay, I don't think, if that's your insurance policy against not hosting this World Cup, because the U.S. has been the towering favorite to host a World Cup before, and that was 2022. And we all know what happened then. There were a bunch of shenanigans, and Qatar ran off with it. I don't think that would have been as likely this time around, because the voting structure has changed to where, rather than like 23 or 24 people get to vote, all the federations get to vote. So it's spread out over 209 people now. So, you know, that kind of collusion and bribery would have been a lot harder to pull off this time around. But FIFA is a fickle beast. And if this means the U.S. will for sure have another World Cup, I think that's a very low price to pay.
Yeah, I think it's good that the United States kind of doesn't really lose much in terms of the marquee matchups. And I look at it kind of from a bigger picture. When the United States hosted the World Cup in 1994 and got that bid, it was very much in an effort to grow the sport in the country and kind of build off the momentum that was seen when the program was kind of turned around in the mid-80s that culminated with the birth in the 1990 World Cup, the first in 40 years for the United States, and then hosting the World Cup in 1994. So back then, it was more about the United States itself. Now I think it's more about being a trendsetter on the world stage. What I mean by that is, this is the first bid. It's not the first time that two countries will have, or multiple countries will have hosted the World Cup, but if I'm not mistaken, this will be the first one with a 48-team tournament, right? Yes. And for the United States to come on and say, well, this is, you know, we're going to host it in a different fashion to accommodate the different fashion, it kind of gives the country a little bit more of a reputation of, we're not just here to try to get the game going again in our country. Now our goals have changed. We've been to the knockout stages the last couple World Cups. Who knows if that'll continue, but you know, the program's in a better place, and we're going to be trendsetters in a way and have a bigger seat at the world table. So I kind of look at it from that broader perspective.
Yeah, I'm basically cool with it. I think from Leander's perspective, from the point of view of hedging our bets in the current world political climate, U.S. on its own doing anything alarms people.
So we won't get too deep into that, but yes, you're right. No, you're right.
So that's cool. And then as someone who, you know, is a fan and covers soccer, I you know, it'd be fun to go to World Cup games across the States, but it'd also be fun to go to one in Mexico City and up in Vancouver and in Montreal. So to me, I'm pretty okay with the whole thing.
Before we get out of here, I want to give you guys thoughts on Bruce Arena's belief that the U.S. by 2026, if the World Cup is held here, that the U.S. will be competing for a world championship by then. What did you guys make of that comment? And, you know, the reason I bring it up is because we had, you know, Jurgen Klinsmann before, he, you know, he's said that the target for 2018, he said some things like, the goal is to make the semifinals in Russia, and then before 2014, before even the World Cup began for the U.S. and Brazil, in a very much publicized New York Times story, said the U.S. has no chance of winning that World Cup, which it was the comment was based in reality, but you know, people who aren't soccer fans really took off and ran with it. You know, Michael Wilbon was basically saying, you know, let's kick Klinsmann out of the country. So here we have Bruce Arena, who's rejuvenated the U.S. men's national team. What do you guys think of him, this vision of his that the U.S. will be a World Cup title favorite or contender?
I have no problem with that, because any time the U.S. has been ambitious and sort of laughably optimistic, it's sort of worked out well. You know, when they talked about hosting the World Cup, they got it done. When they wanted to start advancing, that worked out. When they had Project 2010, you know, to try to win the World Cup by then, they obviously didn't win it, but it produced some good players. And, you know, it's any time they sort of take moonshots, it tends to have good ramifications. The notable exception there is probably hiring Jurgen Klinsmann. That didn't work out so well, but still, it moved the bar a little bit to where the U.S. was no longer content to reach the round of 16 because they had this big-time coach. And where the Klinsmann era is also a time when U.S. soccer started putting a lot more money into development and all these things. So, you know, even if – is it realistic? That remains to be seen. Probably not entirely. It's a pretty short turnaround. But, you know, being ambitious has paid off in the past for U.S. soccer. So I have no problem with them setting the bar high for themselves.
This actually reminds me of something. A few years ago when Andre Villas-Boas was here with Tottenham, I was at a presser and I asked him a question. I just basically asked him in general what he thought of sort of the state of MLS and soccer in America. And before he was fired and banished to the nether regions of Russia and China, he answered my question and he said, I'll say this. If the next 10 years of soccer in the United States can be as fruitful as the last 10 years have been, then we'd really be looking at something.
Yeah, it's hard to forecast something like this down the road because it's generational. What Leander mentioned in terms of like recommitting to the talent pool and kind of growing the youth programs and things like that. And so that's when you'll start to see who could maybe surround Pulisic, because it seems like he's going to be a central figure for a long time to come. You also, Jordan Morris, DeAndre Yedlin, if they develop correctly, Emerson Hyneman, Matt Miazga, who knows. So it's kind of laughable almost to predict what's going to happen at the 2022 World Cup, let alone the one that's going to happen 4 years after that. But I do feel a little bit more comfortable with Arena doing it because Klinsmann, for as much as I did like about him, he also kind of, you know, the stuff that you mentioned, Joe, like he kind of talked about it both sides of his mouth. He says, on one hand, this team's not good enough to win the World Cup this year, but in Russia we'll be semifinals. Like, well, what the hell changed? And then I feel like Bruce Arena is uniquely suited because who knows how long he's going to stick in the job. He's getting up there in age. But he is very experienced, and he's kind of in a unique position to oversee who the future, who's the manager after him. And so when he says it, I think it's a little bit more stable and trustworthy. But it's okay for the team to have a steadier leader say something like that.
You know, when I think of what the U.S. men's national team will be like in 2026, I don't think about the senior squad. I think about, you know, what shape is the U.S. soccer program in? You know, and we've talked briefly about, you know, how messed up the youth soccer system is here in this country. It's so fractured. You know, the reason why Christian Pulisic was able to succeed is because his dad is an ex-player, had connections, got him to go play in, you know, in England or live in England for a little bit as a young child. Went on playing in the streets, you know, or the park with kids. And that's how you, you know, that's one way of developing talent. Here, you know, in the U.S., but you know, my hope is that we will figure it out. That the coaching will be right. That everyone, that you don't have this pay-for-play system where all coaches want to do is pick the biggest, fastest, strongest kids for them to win games, so they can keep this business that they have, you know, going. It's not so much about player development. It's, you know, how many kids can I get in here every year so I'm making my money. As long as U.S. soccer is focused on player development, you know, along with Major League Soccer, with their academies, who knows what might happen. You know, it takes years, for decades, for you to grow into a world soccer power. And that's what you're talking about with the U.S. competing for a World Cup. And, you know, at some point we might get there, I don't know. But as long as we're doing the right things, you know, of the grassroots to the ground level, then, you know, that's all you can do. And, you know, by 2026, it'll be an exciting time in America because we'll probably have the Olympics in 2024 right here in Los Angeles. We got another important vote coming. Look, we got to run, but thank you to Joey Galino, who was serving as our producer exemplar, Alex Baker, Leander Charlackins. I'm Joe Lago. Thanks again for tuning into our podcast, and we'll catch you next time.